Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight to hear Kevin Rudd, and special welcome to Mr. Gough Whitlam, who's in the front row, a former speaker at the Sydney Institute. Good to see you again. So I'll be very brief with my introduction. Kevin Rudd is well known. Started as a career diplomat with posts in Stockholm and Beijing, chief of staff to Premier Wayne Goss in Queensland, head of the Cabinet Office in Queensland, China consultant for KPMG, Shadow Minister for Foreign Affairs from 2001, of course the MHR for Griffith from 1998, and currently with the title of Shadow Minister for Foreign Affairs and International Security. Kevin Rudd has been to the Institute before, but he makes a most welcome return to discuss the topic, Leading Not Following, the Revival of Australian Middle Power Diplomacy. Mr. Rudd, you're welcome.
Gerard Henderson, Anne Henderson, friends and supporters of the Sydney Institute, E.G. Whitlam, great helmsman of us all. Good to have you with us, Gough, and father of the Republic to be. Don't be so pessimistic, Anne. My argument to you tonight is that over the last decade, Australia has increasingly become a follower rather than a leader in international affairs. I will argue that Australia, under the Howard government, in a significant departure from its predecessor, has progressively abandoned the practice of creative middle power diplomacy. I'll also argue that this approach has not maximised Australia's foreign and trade policy interests, and the time has come to confidently redefine a new middle power diplomacy for the 21st century. And I'll argue all three of these propositions confidently on the assumption that none of them violate Australia's obligations under the United States alliance. The Australian Labor Party's policy approach to our place in the region and the world is anchored in the three pillars of Labor foreign policy, these in turn being anchored in the national platform of the ALP. They are: first, our alliance with the United States; second, our membership of the United Nations; and third, our policy of comprehensive engagement in Asia. Labor is proud of its role in the formation of the US alliance when Curtin first looked to America in 1941. Every successive Labor government and opposition since Curtin has reaffirmed our commitment to that alliance. It is anchored in our view that in the post-war history of the world, America has been an overwhelming force for good. It is also anchored in our view that the US strategic presence in East Asia and the West Pacific in the post-1975 period has created the necessary strategic stability to underpin the economic and, in part, political transformation of East Asia. Labor also believes that Australia's defence and intelligence needs are greatly enhanced as a result of our security and intelligence treaties with the United States. In this context, it is often forgotten that Australia's accession to the EUCUSA agreement that underpins our access to US global intelligence arrangements occurred under the Chifley Labor government well prior to the signing of the ANZUS Treaty under Menzies in 1951. However, for Labor, our alliance with the United States does not automatically mandate our compliance with every element of US foreign policy. This marks a fundamental difference between ourselves and the Conservatives. We disagreed with Washington over Vietnam. We disagreed with Washington over the Second Iraq War, having been the first ally militarily to support the US during the First Iraq War. And we disagree with Washington's posture on a range of other matters, from global climate change to Guantanamo Bay. We also believe that such differences can be managed within the fabric of a robust alliance relationship. The second pillar of Labor's foreign policy is our membership of the United Nations. Labor under Foreign Minister Evatt played a significant middle power role at the San Francisco Conference in 1945 in carving out a place for middle and small powers in the drafting of the UN Charter and in the emerging architecture of the United Nations organisation. Evatt's logic remains valid 60 years later for middle powers like Australia. That is, we have a fundamental national interest at stake in an international rules-based order that protects smaller states from more powerful states. A rules-based order also enables smaller states to negotiate the international security, political and economic systems with a degree of predictability, free from the rolling threat of territorial invasion that regularly challenged the international order in the 1920s and the 1930s. For these reasons, Labor, both in government and opposition, has maintained a deep commitment to Australian multilateral diplomacy, both as a mechanism through which we can make a contribution to improve the international order and at the same time using the multilateral rules-based system to leverage our position in pursuit of our national interests. While the Conservatives under Menzies and Fraser never exhibited the same level of enthusiasm for Australian multilateralism as we saw with Chifley and Whitlam, it is fair to say this gap has widened greatly between Labor and the Liberals over the past 20 years. The third pillar of Labor foreign policy is our approach to comprehensive engagement with Asia. This began with Chifley's and Evatt's support for the Indonesian independence movement of the 1940s, in defiance of the Dutch and to the dismay of most of the great powers at the time. This tradition of engagement continued under Mr. Whitlam, with the diplomatic recognition of China in 1972, Labor's electoral loss in 1949 having prevented Australia from arriving at the same rational conclusion some 20 years earlier. If there has been a core conceptual difference between Labor and the Liberals over the last half century on Australia's engagement with Asia, it has been this. Labor has sought to secure Australia's future in Asia, while the Liberals, until most recently, have sought to secure Australia's future by defending us from Asia. The depth of these differences of approach to Asian regional engagement continued right through until November last year, when Mr. Howard finally yielded to Labor's historical critique of Mr. Howard's opposition to Asian engagement. Following much prompting from Labor, Mr. Howard finally agreed to sign a Treaty of Amity and Cooperation with ASEAN, which was a precondition for participation in the inaugural East Asian Summit. This was the Prime Minister who, when Leader of the Opposition, campaigned actively on the need to reduce Asian immigration to Australia. How things have changed. Nonetheless, we should always be cautious about this Prime Minister's capacity to flick the switch to Hansenism, if and when domestic political circumstances so dictate. Nonetheless, in summary, on the question of Australia's long-term engagement with the region, let the history books now record that Mr. Howard has finally conceded this core argument to Labor. These, then, are the three fundamental pillars of Australian foreign policy: alliance of the United States, membership of the United Nations, and a policy of comprehensive engagement with Asia. And it is within this conceptual architecture that I argue the time has come for Australia to resuscitate its tradition of middle power diplomacy, which we have so effectively deployed in the past. Last week at the Institute of International Affairs in Canberra, I reflected on whether governments, in particular long-term governments, effectively use the political mandate they are given by the Australian people to advance the long-term interests of the nation, or whether governments, even long-term governments, simply become trapped in the day-to-day politics of issue management, with the overriding objective being the maintenance of incumbency at all costs rather than a program of long-term national reform. Let me restate some of the principles I outlined last week in that address. The purpose of government is not simply to be in government. The purpose of government is to provide leadership in the long-term national interest. Government provides opportunities which may be seized or opportunities which may be squandered. The Hawke and Keating governments seized the opportunities that they were presented with to lay the foundations for Australia's long-term economic prosperity. They did this through floating the currency, deregulating interest rates, finance sector reform, dismantling the tariff wall, the negotiation and implementation of national competition policy, a far-reaching array of microeconomic reforms brought about through the new federalism, and a revolution in national savings policy through the introduction of universal compulsory superannuation. These were big policy decisions, each involved great political pain. Each, however, produced long-term policy gain for the nation. And they were driven by a long-term strategic commitment to enhance Australia's long-term international economic competitiveness by enhancing productivity growth. On foreign policy, the period of the Hawke and Keating governments equally was one of foreign policy dynamism for Australia. The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, the Chemical Weapons Convention, the Cambodian Peace Settlement, the establishment of APEC, the establishment of the ASEAN Regional Forum, the only pan-regional forum on security policy matters to this day, all the product of effective, high-level, Australian middle-power diplomacy. By contrast, the foreign policy legacy of the Howard government has been reactive, following the United States into Iraq, following the United States on Guantanamo Bay, following the United States in their refusal to ratify the Kyoto Convention on Global Climate Change, failing to anticipate security policy challenges emerging from the rise of Jamaat Islamiya here in our own region, the refusal to take the lead on the Solomon Islands early until the government's hand was finally forced, the failure to effectively respond to the emerging law and order challenges of Papua New Guinea, and a failure to anticipate East Timor's long-term security needs. If there is one common denominator in this long list of policy failures, it has been a government responding to events rather than a government anticipating events, a passive rather than an active strategy for government. This is the exact reverse of Labor's foreign policy tradition, which has always sought to be ahead of the curve rather than be behind it, anticipating, not just responding to events, and most critically, deploying Australia's formidable diplomatic capital through a creative foreign policy innovation of a respected middle power. Once again, opportunities seized, not opportunities squandered. The same is also evident if we contrast Australia's trade policy achievements over the course of the Hawke, Keating and Howard governments as well. Australia, under Labor Trade Ministers Dawkins, Duffy, Evans, McMullen and Cook, championed the cause of multilateral trade liberalisation and agricultural free trade in particular. Let's be absolutely clear about this. The Australian Labor government, under Trade Minister Dawkins, put agricultural trade liberalisation on the GATT WTO formal agenda for the first time. There had been 9 previous failed attempts to do so, going back to the time when the GATT was first established in 1947. Australia succeeded at Punta del Este in 1986 because Australia established a new negotiating group in the Uruguay round, the Cairns Group, took over the chairmanship of this group, and then leveraged the US and the Europeans to include agriculture for the first time. As a commentary at the time in the US Journal of Commerce noted, and I quote, "The mighty Cairns Group succeeded in embarrassing both the European community and the United States into serious negotiations on farm talks." 15 years later, an OECD paper reached a similar conclusion. The Uruguay round on agriculture, it said, was a watershed in that agriculture was finally subjected to multilateral rules and disciplines. Specific reform requirements were mandated in 3 areas: market access, export subsidies, and domestic support. The disciplines on export subsidies were the most effective part of the Uruguay round, with countries less able to resort to export subsidies when world markets weakened, unquote. In summary, the establishment of the Cairns Group and the critical role that it played during the conclusion of the Uruguay round provided a further demonstration of Australian middle power diplomacy at its best. The Hawke Labor government, through John Dawkins, succeeded in initiating the formation of a third force of trade liberalising agricultural exporters capable of generating a new dynamic in the global trade negotiation process. In addition, the Hawke Labor government revamped the Trade Department and appointed Australia's first full-time ambassador to the GATT. And Labor Trade Minister Michael Duffy, who succeeded Dawkins for the first time in the history of the GATT, proceeded to prepare a comprehensive plan to reform world trade and agriculture. It was this plan that shaped the agreement to reform agricultural trade that was finally adopted as one of the historic outcomes of the Uruguay round. When the coalition government was elected in 1996, it inherited the rich political and diplomatic capital that had accrued to Australia's good name as a result of the central role that previous Labor governments had played in bringing the Uruguay round to a successful conclusion. 10 years later, this inheritance, regrettably, has largely been squandered. Australia did not play a leadership role in the resolution of the protracted debate over the Director Generalship of the WTO between New Zealand and Thailand, both members of the Cairns Group that Australia had created and that Australia chaired. Australia also failed to play a leadership role at the Seattle Ministerial Conference in 1999, which simply imploded. And once the Doha round got going, Trade Minister Vale saw the Cairns Group, which he chaired, effectively dismembered as 12 of its 18 member states defected to a new group, the G20, chaired by Brazil. If ever you wanted to see a single event which brought about the collapse of Australian middle power trade diplomacy, this was it. Furthermore, Australia under Mr. Vale's chairmanship of the Cairns Group has not produced during the Doha round so far a formal policy position of its own in order to break the impasse between the EU, the US and the G20. Neither the Trade Minister nor the Prime Minister have advanced anything resembling a coordinated political or diplomatic strategy in the capitals of North America, Western Europe, China and India in order to bring this round to a successful conclusion. The Doha round has suffered from the lack of a committed global product champion. This provided a country like Australia copious fertile ground in which to deploy Australian middle power diplomacy. Instead, the government has run 1,000 miles away, refusing to risk any of its political capital on an enterprise as risky as this. Despite all this, let's hope that Mr. Vale in Cairns this week, at the 20th anniversary celebration of the establishment of the Cairns Group by Labor, manages to secure an agreement from the other participants on a fixed date, venue and agenda for a further meeting of the principals immediately following the US midterm elections. The decline and fall of Australian middle power diplomacy over the last decade has not just been shaped by a Prime Minister and ministers unprepared to step outside their comfort zone. It has also been reinforced by an overwhelming predisposition on the part of the Howard government to rely on bilateralism rather than creative multilateralism to advance Australia's national interests. We see this in security policy, where the government stands idly by while the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty disintegrates before our very eyes, in the absence of any effective multilateral initiative from Australia, and while the government contemplates instead the possibility of a bilateral uranium supply agreement with India outside the framework of the NPT. We see the same approach on trade policy, where the government has dedicated the bulk of its political and diplomatic capital to the negotiation of bilateral free trade agreements, while refusing to dedicate parallel resources to the successful conclusion of the Doha multilateral round. We see the same on global climate change, where the government actively seeks to sabotage the Kyoto Protocol that it signed back in 1997 and remains, with the United States, the only two developed countries in the world outside this multilateral framework. A combination of political timidity, a bureaucracy which has been taught that creative policy innovation is not that which this government primarily rewards, combined with an overarching preference for a bilateral deal over a multilateral initiative, means that Australia's long-established tradition of creative, effective, middle-power diplomacy has withered on the vine. The concept of middle powers in the international system and the strategic behaviour that they exhibit has been the subject of long debate. The concept goes back to the origins of the European state system. In the 15th century, the mayor of Milan, Giovanni Vitero, divided the world into three types of states: grandissime, empires; mezzano, middle powers; and piccoli, small powers. According to Vitero, a mezzano, or a middle power, has sufficient strength and authority to stand on its own without the need of help from others. Today we would call this defence self-reliance. In studying the gradation of powers in the international system, writers like Martin Wright, Carsten Holbrad and Hedley Bull have focused on military capability and economic development as the two broad criteria for measuring power in the international system. Middle powers were clearly larger and more able to project force than the small states, but lacked the global reach of the great powers. More recently, the concept of middle power diplomacy has also been broadened to include moral leadership within the international system. The former, that is military power, being about the potential exercise of hard power; the latter, that is moral leadership, the exercise of so-called soft power. The central characteristic of Australian middle power diplomacy has been coalition building with like-minded states, in order to create the political momentum necessary to bring about multilateral diplomatic outcomes. This is because, while Australia is not a superpower, it is nonetheless a significant power with a keen interest in shaping the strategic order. Five broad characteristics can be observed to describe an effective middle power strategy over time. First, Australia has generally sought to maintain an independence of diplomatic action within an alliance framework. Second, Australia's middle power diplomacy has historically demonstrated a strong commitment to collective security principles as embodied in the United Nations Charter. Third, Australian middle power diplomacy has had a strong, but by no means exclusive, regional focus. Fourth, Australia's middle power tradition requires a high degree of defence self-reliance. In order to play a credible role in regional security dynamics, middle powers like Australia need to sustain sufficient strategic weight in order to influence security outcomes. In other words, it is the objective calculus of Australia's strategic weight which in part shapes the strategic choices of others. Fifth, an effective middle power diplomacy for Australia requires an extensive diplomatic network, well-maintained diplomatic relationships across a broad geographical spectrum, particularly if rapid diplomatic coalition building is to be possible, and a creative, innovative policy planning capability within the Foreign Ministry if outside the square diplomatic solutions are to be properly developed and implemented. For Australia, despite a decade of neglect, most of the national software and hardware underpinning an effective middle power diplomatic strategy remains intact. The mystery is, at some stage during the last decade, Australia's long-standing tradition of innovative, independent diplomacy appears to have been snap-frozen. Ask yourself this simple question. Identify now in your minds which major global or regional diplomatic initiative the Howard government is currently championing in its own right. It's hard to answer that question. I follow these debates closely, and I could not do so when someone put that question to me recently. Certainly none come to mind at the multilateral level, and beyond the Solomon Islands and East Timor, where Australia, in relative terms, is a metropolitan power exercising military might following a failure of diplomacy, none come to mind at the regional level either. And all this at a time when the global and regional challenges facing our country are of an unprecedented complexity. Tonight, I would like to identify five specific areas where Australia should now take the lead in developing an independent diplomatic initiative, in part because currently there is a vacuum, in part because the areas I propose to nominate are of great material relevance to Australia's national interest, and in part because Australia in each of these areas has long-standing bona fides. First, Australia should establish a national diplomatic initiative aimed at restoring the integrity of the nuclear non-proliferation regime. Following recent developments involving North Korea, Iran, the sale of Pakistan's nuclear secrets by AQ Khan, and the decision by the United States to engage in nuclear cooperation with India outside the framework of the NPT, the current non-proliferation regime is fundamentally fracturing. The concept of and the consequences of the collapse of this regime for Australia are acute, including the possible outbreak of regional nuclear arms races in South Asia, Northeast Asia, and even possibly Southeast Asia. The impact on Australia's long-term national security interests is immense. Australia, as a member of the Nuclear Suppliers Group, has a responsibility to promote the NPT. Mr. Howard must, as a matter of urgency, launch an Australian initiative by convening an international conference of like-minded states in Canberra. This would work in conjunction with our existing proposal to establish a diplomatic caucus of like-minded states to promote the NPT. The fact is, through the range of arms control and disarmament initiatives launched during Gareth Evans' foreign ministership, Australia has retained technical and diplomatic credibility within the field. That's why Australia should lead an initiative to explore options for reinvigorating and strengthening the NPT at this critical time. That's why Labor will be debating the future of the NPT at its national conference next April. Second, Australia over the next 3 months must launch its own national Doha initiative in order to achieve a breakthrough in the round. The US Fast Track Authority expires in July 2007. There is a narrow window of opportunity during a three-month period between December 06 and March 07 when agreement could still be reached. The negotiating gap between the three groups on market access, export subsidies and domestic support is bridgeable. But once again, this requires creative diplomacy and a Prime Minister engaging in an intensive global and regional political offensive to create the political momentum necessary to bring Doha to a successful conclusion. Australia launched a similar national initiative during a critical stage in the Uruguay round. The time has come to do so again. Third, China looms as a key to any effective global response to the challenge of global climate change. China, unlike Australia, has signed and ratified Kyoto. What is up for debate are the specific obligations that should accrue to China after 2012. Australia should initiate a government-to-government level Australia-China Commission on Global Climate Change. Australia has good diplomatic relations with Beijing. Australia is also a major energy supplier to China. Australia, therefore, has a direct environmental and economic interest at stake in helping shape China's response to the global climate change challenge. Fourth, Australia, as the chair of APEC in 2007, should develop an APEC reform initiative. The truth is, the uncomfortable truth, is that since the Kuala Lumpur meeting of APEC in 1998, APEC has been steadily losing its political and economic policy momentum. Given that the establishment of APEC was the result of an Australian Labor government initiative, Mr. Howard must now develop a comprehensive proposal to re-establish APEC as the principal deliberative forum of the region. APEC possesses the potential to reduce over time some of the bilateral brittleness in the relationships between China, Japan, and the United States. APEC also has the potential to be deployed to politically re-energise the Doha round, as it did in relation to the Uruguay round in the early 1990s. One practical measure the Prime Minister should champion at the Sydney Summit and in the 12 months leading up to it is a truly integrated strategy for responding to regional pandemics, including avian influenza. In addition to this, they will be advancing further policy initiatives for that Sydney APEC Summit in the 12 months ahead. Fifth, Australia should launch a high-level initiative to accelerate the establishment of an integrated regional disaster coordination authority for the Asia-Pacific region at large. Earthquakes, tsunamis and volcanic activity across Southeast Asia and the West Pacific remain of acute concern to all regional states. ASEAN and the ASEAN Regional Forum, itself part of an Australian diplomatic initiative, have begun some tentative work in this area. Australia should take the lead in driving this process forward, both diplomatically and operationally. Australia should consider offering either Darwin or Townsville as an integrated regional headquarters for the coordination of national defence and emergency services contributions to a given regional natural disaster event. Apart from the positive contribution this could make in response to future disasters, where emergency responses in the past have been relatively slow, using the ASEAN Regional Forum for this purpose could construct over time a useful confidence and security building measure in a region which at present has few such measures. If Australia in the future is to re-enter the field as a practitioner of effective middle power diplomacy, we need to recreate within our foreign ministry the policy horsepower to develop, fine-tune and implement initiatives of the type I've just referred to. This has not been possible over the last decade when Foreign Minister Downer has presided over the de-skilling of the department, the denuding of DFAT's policy staff, and the abolition of DFAT's policy planning function. DFAT in 2006 has less policy staff than it had in 1996, despite Bali, despite September 11, and despite the regional campaign against terrorism, and despite the proliferation of other security and trade policy challenges confronting Australia over that period. DFAT needs to be injected with policy resources to do the job it once did. For this reason, a Labor government will establish an Office of Strategic Policy within the department as a high-level policy planning capability for the minister and the government. Rather than simply responding to international events as they unfold, Labor will establish a long-term policy and strategic planning capability with a view to shaping events and positioning Australia for the environment it will confront in 10, 20 and 50 years' time. All substantial foreign ministries around the world have such a capability. It is remarkable that Australia does not, particularly in a period when our defence and intelligence agencies have had their resources augmented so significantly in the 5 years since September 11. It is time to restore the balance when it comes to Australian foreign and trade policy. Renewing Australia's middle power diplomacy will be a priority for the next Labor government. Because the art of diplomacy is not to fight wars, it is to prevent wars and to peacefully advance our broader interests in the international domain. That is why Australia's diplomatic, security and intelligence efforts must be prosecuted in tandem if we are to maximise our national security and other interests in the decade ahead. Creative middle power diplomacy must represent a core part of Australia's national capabilities as we face the range of regional and global challenges in the decade ahead. Australia can either wait for events to unfold, or Australia can be on the front foot and, where possible, be part of the solution. The Australian character is not to stand idly by. Rather, it is to act, to lead, not to follow. Thank you for your time.
So many thanks, Kevin Rudd, for an important speech. Thanks also to Mellisons for the use of this facility. And so we come to question and discussion time. Could I start off? Of course, were the Shadow Minister in the lead-up to the 2004 election. Presumably you'll be Shadow Minister to the lead-up of the 2007 election. What kind of different emphasis would there be in a year's time from what there was 2 years ago? Have you changed much in that time?
I think as the Shadow Minister for Foreign Affairs and Trade, the challenges we'll face in 12 months' time will go to the critical categories of security and the critical categories of how to advance our international trading interests. In the security basket, I think if there's a change over the last year or so, it's along these lines. I think the Australian public want to see policies which deal with terrorism in a substantive rather than a rhetorical way. They want to see in the region effective counter-terrorism strategies, not simply rhetorical declarations. The same applies to security on the home front as well. When it comes to Southeast Asia, for example, one of the proposals we put before the Australian people in the lead-up to the 2004 election was the need for a comprehensive counter-terrorism strategy for Southeast Asia. What were the elements of it? Firstly, an audit of the gaps in our policing, intelligence and border control systems across Southeast Asia, where there is much porousness. Secondly, developing assistance programs for regional police services and border control authorities to plug those gaps. And thirdly, and this is the important third element, to work effectively on a hearts and minds strategy in Southeast Asia. Because the truth is, any effective strategy for dealing with terrorism at home or abroad has to be hard-edged and security-laden on the one hand, and on the other hand, be mindful of where terrorist organisations and jihadists recruit from on the other. One of the things that we'll therefore take to the next election on the latter point is the need to resuscitate and rebuild Radio Australia. In Indonesia, population 230, 240 million, since the emasculation of Radio Australia by the Howard government and the sale of the Cox Peninsula transmitters and the halving of our Indonesian language broadcasting services through Radio Australia, our ability to transmit a message effectively in Bahasa Indonesia across the archipelago has been neutered. Therefore, if we are concerned about hearts and minds, if we are concerned about a message about Australia, which is not simply being delivered by the Hezbollah or Hamas Bahasa Indonesia websites, we have vacated the field. That is a practical measure in terms of hearts and minds. The final point in answer to your question on the trade front is this. We at heart are multilateralists, as I've said before. If the Doha round hasn't collapsed by the end of next year, we would see one of our principal responsibilities is taking up the initiative which I referred to in my speech. We need urgently an Australian honest broker advocacy for bridging the gap between the three principal negotiating groups. If this round collapses, I draw people's attention to what Mandelson has said in the front page of today's Financial Review. That is that the European Union is about to embark on a series of free trade agreements, presumably regional or bilateral, and where all that leads in terms of the ultimate undermining of the WTO and the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, and more broadly the multilateral trading system, I am quite fearful of. We may well be at one of those crossroads, urgent diplomatic intervention now, based on political will, is needed to save not just the round, but I believe the future of the multilateral trading system.
Ellis?
Kevin, a couple of years ago when you spoke to the Institute, I remember you saying how important it was, because at that time we were negotiating some new joint facilities with the United States, how important it was for us to know what they would do and what status of forces agreement they would operate under. Now that we've got them, and since your interest would have continued, could you tell us a little bit more about what has happened?
Sure. Within certain constraints, I can. I'm always worried, Alison, when you can remember what I've said 2 years ago. Sometimes I'm uncertain as I can record what I said 2 years ago, including at such illustrious forums as the Sydney Institute. Look, when it comes to the joint facilities operated between Australia and the United States, our position is the same as the government. We do not comment publicly on their operations. Our declaratory position on them is consistent with the government's. All I can say by way of broad policy is that Australia's national intelligence needs are served immensely by those arrangements. And this is particularly relevant in the continuing war against terrorism. In terms of other arrangements beyond the intelligence facilities, which I think is maybe where your question is heading, and that is arrangements which have been reached between the United States and Australia for the use of air bases and facilities in northern Australia. The opposition is satisfied that those arrangements do not in any way violate our national security or foreign policy interests. We've examined those in detail, particularly my colleague, the Shadow Minister for Defence. Were we to find either operationally anything to the contrary, we would re-enter ourselves discussions with the government and the Americans on that. But we are satisfied that our national interests are served by those arrangements.
Michael Foley,
Mr. Rudd, thank you very much for a very rich speech and a bracing and very ambitious agenda for Australian middle power diplomacy. Thank you for the five items that you mentioned. Can I ask you about a sixth item, and that is what kind of progress through the sort of muscular creative diplomacy you talk about, could we achieve towards abolition of capital punishment, particularly in our own region, which is where we have the most developed diplomatic network of which you spoke, where we have a history of leading a clever, intelligent, pointy diplomatic efforts, whether it's the Cambodian peace process or APEC, where more than 80% of the world's executions take place, but yet where there is some progress, where there are a number of Asian states that have abolished the death penalty, most recently Philippines. So what kind of middle power agenda would a Labor government have on abolition of capital punishment?
As a matter of policy, Labor's position on capital punishment is as follows. We have a policy of universal opposition to capital punishment in any jurisdiction, at any time, under any circumstances. Secondly, when it comes to the application of capital punishment to any Australian citizen, we act to intervene with the relevant host government. We've done it in the past with Vietnam, with some success. We've done so most recently in Singapore with abject failure. And, of course, we are all in this room conscious of where those representations will need to go in the future, possibly in connection with Indonesia, subject to the final determinations by the Indonesian judicial process. When it comes to a diplomatic initiative, One of the things that we have debated internally and we continue to develop is whether there is a possibility of establishing an international commission which Australia could lead or assist in establishing, which has the explicit objective of establishing a new norm in international law, that is, the abolition by all states of capital punishment. Personally, I'm attracted to this approach. My abhorrence towards capital punishment is well known to many in this room. I think this is a proposal worth developing. Of course, one of the problems that we face in this is that it is not just non-democracies around the world which apply capital punishment. The United States is a classic exception where I think at last count 32 states of the Union were still using capital punishment of one form or another. So my answer to your question, Michael, having read your paper on this some weeks ago as well, is that we are positively predisposed towards acting in this direction, but a final policy announcement from us will still be some time away.
I agree about the middle power bit, but to some of our nearest neighbours, we're not a middle power, we're a big power. And with increasing worry about security and worry about the dysfunctionality of many of these small countries, we've got Solomons, we've got East Timor, Papua New Guinea and West Papua, whatever, do you see, and how would Labor respond, do you see a future where increasingly we're going to be seen like the Big Brother or the America of this area, and how would Labor face that?
You're right to speak of the challenges of East Timor, Papua New Guinea and Solomon Islands in a context different from that which I've advanced in this speech. In part of the speech, I referred to the fact that the interventions in the Solomons and East Timor are in fact the actions of a, in relative terms, great power. Metropolitan power, I think, was the term that I used. And anyone who knows the relativities of population, economic size, military wherewithal would concur with that assessment. The challenge, therefore, the immediate challenges, let's call it the Southwest Pacific, in which I would momentarily include East Timor, are of a different type to the subject matter of my speech this evening. When it comes to, say, the Solomon Islands, the real problem which has arisen there is a failure of our policy planning capability. If you look at the first requests for material assistance from Australia from the government of the Solomons, they came sometime around 2001, 2002. In fact, a visiting Australian parliamentary delegation met with the then government at the time in Honiara. A letter was then sent from the deputy chairman of that delegation, Duncan Kerr, to Foreign Minister Downer, outlining a very modest proposal, that is a request for assistance from the Solomons. As I recall it, and I stand to be corrected, for some 40 or 50 coppers. Now, Mr. Downer rejected that out of hand, in fact, more broadly, rejected any form of police, let alone military intervention, through 0102, 0304, until we got to the events of Ramsay. The problem was, acting earlier, at a more modest level, would conceivably have assisted in stabilising, at a modest, almost below the radar way, the security situation on the ground in the Sols. The consequence of not acting earlier in a modest level, which was less confrontational to the body politic in the Solomons at the time, is that we now have a much higher profile, much more costly intervention in terms of the Australian taxpayer than would otherwise have needed to have been the case. So I think, in a different way, the Sols, the Solomon Islands, illustrates the broader need for an effective policy planning capability which looks over the radar at emerging lower-level security needs across the island states of the Southwest Pacific. The Solomon Islands are not alone in this category. There are security threats in other states in the region as well. I won't identify them by name. But earlier, more modest, police-based intervention is far better than simply discovering one day that diplomacy hasn't worked and we need to therefore intervene in a much more upfront, large-scale military manner. The problems with doing the latter and not doing the former is this. If it's a very large-scale upfront military intervention, you can run the risk of creating the dynamic within local politics of Australia being the object of local political opposition and debate. That is a concern that we have for events downstream in East Timor. That is a concern we have for events downstream in the Solomons as well.
Mr. Rudd, I noted with interest your criticism of the Howard government's failure to identify the risks of Jamaah Ismailia in Indonesia. It would be unfair to ask you what they should have done, but had you been in government at that time, prior to the Bali terrorist attacks, what could you have done in the face of an Indonesian government which has expressed extreme displeasure at our attempt to doing anything that affects their internal policies?
The reason I said what I said in the speech about failing to anticipate the emergence of Jamaah Islamiyah was I was paraphrasing, in fact, the formal public statements from the then Director General of ASIO, Dennis Richardson, who said the same. I've not seek to ascribe to the government something which the government has not, through its chief intelligence head, ascribed to itself. So that's the first point. Secondly, someone who travels regularly to Jakarta, let me tell you, I'm fully seized of the complexity of dealing with governments as they have come and gone in Jakarta over the last several years since the end of the new order period. But in terms of how you deal effectively with counter-terrorism on the ground in Indonesia, as I said before, there are two arms to an effective strategy. One is what the Australian Federal Police in large part have been seeking to do relatively unobtrusively on the ground, which is to build an effective working level relationship with their counterparts in Jakarta. There are still gaps in that. But in terms of hard-edge policing, there has been much effective work done. Where my criticism lies is on the second arm in particular, namely what I've described earlier as an effective hearts and minds strategy. One of the consequences of Australia's response to the tsunami was to take up a much earlier Labor Party proposal that we engage in an education enhancement program for schools in the most affected areas of Java. Affected, I mean, in terms of the impact of Jamaah Islamiyah and forms of Wahhabism and Salafism in that part of the archipelago. No one at that stage predicted the tsunami. The tsunami came. The government, I think, quite intelligently, launched a very large-scale aid response to it. Part of those funds, I now understand, are being dedicated to school programs. What's the object in the school programs? To rebuild schools, or in some cases to build schools, and to provide the resources for curriculum development and teacher training for the Indonesian school system, which would otherwise devolve to some of the more radical madrasas and pesantren in that part of Java. Our criticism has always been that when it comes to the hearts and minds strategy, and I referred earlier to Radio Australia, that has been the weaker side of the government's response. If you do that well, it augments and enhances the capacity of the strong arm of your response, which is at the police and security edge.
My question is regarding the Australian-China relationship. China is getting more and more important as a regional player or the world player. China has achieved a high rate of economic growth in the past a quarter century. Some observers said that China will be the world's largest economy in a decade or two, but China is still a politically totalitarian. What is the perspective of the Australian-China relationship of the ALP? Do ALP agree with the government's current policy towards China? If ALP is in office, would ALP press China to start political reform? And if China turns a deaf ear, would ALP take action to make the pressure more forceful? Thank you.
And outline the history of the Western novel in 30 seconds. Yeah. Thank you for the question. Appreciate it. The Australia-China relationship, which, as I said before, was initiated by the great helmsman here in the front row, is one which has occupied some serious policy minds and some less than serious policy minds in Canberra over the last 35 years or more. And My criticism of the Australian government is this, that given the sheer dimensions of the challenge of the rise of China, it doesn't matter who I ask this question of in the Australian bureaucracy, they do not have an answer to this question: do we have an integrated China strategy, one which covers our security policy interests, one which covers obviously our demonstrable economic interests, and as well our human rights interests? That is China over time democratizing, and if not, what can be done about that? This, I think, is a huge deficiency. And if I was identifying a further item of work for the Office of Strategic Planning in the Australian Foreign Ministry, it would be to develop such a strategy for the country. You see, when you talk about the rise of China, we are looking at arguably the single greatest event in geopolitics and geoeconomics since the rise of the United States as a major industrial economy in the last quarter of the 19th century. And this is a big rewrite of the global strategic map that's underway at the moment, and a big rewrite of the distribution of global economic power as well. And based on multiple projections, we're likely to see this fully manifest sometime within the next quarter century. The Goldman Sachs BRICS report, which is the best one around, says that, depending on how you measure the size of the Chinese economy, sometime between 2020 and 2030 will emerge as the, or late 2030s, depending on how you measure GDP, will emerge as the world's largest economy. Now, this is a huge shift. On security policy, it's a huge shift because for the 200 years plus of Australia's settled history, our security policy environment has been dominated by one or two factors. First, the British Empire through until World War II, and then secondly, our alliance with the United States from that time till now. Our security policy has been inextricably woven into those two sets of assumptions. If you have the emergence now of the next superpower, then this presents enormous creative challenges for how we manage our security given this change which is occurring beneath our feet. I won't go into the detail of how we should respond on the security policy side, but can I say, because of the complexity of that, and on the economic side, the fact that China currently wants our resources, but China simultaneously is maintaining great restrictions in terms of Australia's access to its domestic services market, together with the complications on the human rights front, these are fodder indeed for an effective China strategy to be developed by an Office of Strategic Planning. A footnote on democracy. I first went to China to work in 1984. It's 22 years ago now. The China that I see now compared with the China of 1984 is like chalk and cheese. China now is a considerably more liberal society than it was 22 years ago. It doesn't matter which measure you use, whether it's forms of economic freedom, forms of creative freedom, forms of religious freedom. Does it mean that the human rights abuses have been eliminated from China? Of course not. But it would be not objective if I were to stand up here and to say that there has been no change and positive change in that direction. However, there is much to be made up still, and that must form the third part of an integrated China strategy for Australia, which we would need to develop early in our term in office.
Do you think that the Pope needs to apologise for his speech in which Islam and violence were linked?
In your face question, that is. to repeat the question, it was a question to me about whether His Holiness should apologise for...
That's specifically related to Australian foreign policy, I think.
I've just finished penning an article on church and state, and I'm just thinking on which hat I should wear at this stage. And the virtue of the Holy See is it wears simultaneously both, the Vatican State as well as being the head of the church. The honest answer to your question is, in the couple of days since this furore erupted, I've actually not read the full speech. And this is not an evasion, it's just saying I actually have not read the full text of the speech. I think any historical reflection would have to lead you with this conclusion, namely that when it comes to the prosecution of faith by violent means, there is ample evidence of that having occurred in the history of Christianity, at least through until the Inquisition and in some cases beyond, as similarly occurred in the prosecution of Islam in various parts of the world. I've noted carefully what His Holiness has said in response to the reaction which has occurred, and I think it's entirely appropriate that His Holiness has expressed his views in those terms.
There's a question there and then here. Yep, that'll be quick.
Okay. Mr. Rudd, do you think Australia got a good deal in the US-Australia Free Trade Agreement? If not, what would you have done differently? And apropos China.
Okay. I think we'll take one question.
Would you have done in the China Free Trade
Agreement? Agreements. Principle one, we support multilateral trade liberalisation. Why? Because you get a better deal for small and medium economies out of them than you do by bilateral deals where the bigger party always gets the better end of the stick. Secondly, on the US one, remember the National Party said at the time, no sugar, no deal. As a Queenslander, I've got to say, them's fighting words, but they were fighting words which were subsequently cashed in because there was no sugar, but there was a deal. I think Australia's farmers were badly sold out by that in particular. Thirdly, on the US, on the China-Australia free trade negotiations, because there is no agreement at this stage, they've just, I think, concluded round six of negotiations in Beijing last week. Our view is very much this should be examined in terms of its merits, but I add this. We should not have any free trade agreement with China for geopolitical reasons. It has to be substantive in terms of the trade policy dividend that it delivers to the Australian economy. And we would make an objective assessment based on the merits of any such proposed agreement in terms of how it affected Australia's core interest across all sectors of the economy.
Mr. Rudd, you mentioned the policy initiative in bringing together your uranium suppliers group. And the influence that would have on membership of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. We recently had addresses here by Mr. Beasley and Mr. Ferguson, who talked about uranium exports. And I think it was Mr. Beasley who said that Australia would not export to a country which wasn't a member of the Non-Proliferation Group. Which countries would you try to bring together as a member of that group? And how would they have
the influence
on the
non-proliferation treaty? I think the NPT and its fracturing to the point of collapse should be of grave concern to every person in this room. It is not for an idle reason that I listed it as number one priority in the five diplomatic initiatives I suggested that Australia activate through a regeneration of middle power diplomacy. I emphasise again that the consequences of the NPT regime imploding completely are horrendous. We sometimes become loose in our understanding or in our debate or our discussion of the actual impact of nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons, their sheer destructive force is of an order of magnitude that they should command the attention of any policymaker anywhere at any time. My great fear about the complete collapse of the system is that if it goes, confidence which current supporters and members of the regime have will be eroded, and they themselves, for a range of reasons, may seek to take their own national action. I'm particularly concerned about what happens in Northeast Asia, Japan's reaction to any substantive breakout by the DPRK. I'm also concerned about what might happen if there is a re-escalation of tensions between India and Pakistan and the roll-on consequences for so many states across our region. In terms of which states would be invited to such a caucus, obviously you would seek to invite all the declared nuclear states and the non-declared nuclear states as well. On top of that, you would seek to invite those who have had the most substantial profile in arms control and disarmament initiatives over the last couple of decades. You would, for example, ensure that you included countries like the Scandinavians who have been active in this area and the Canadians. You would also ensure, overlapping with the Canadians, that you had the uranium suppliers involved as well. The key thing is to ensure that the initiative was well defined, well articulated, well argued, with substantive policy papers attached, and that Above all, you had prime ministerial level advocacy to ensure that those principles, both nuclear weapon states and uranium suppliers and others involved in the overall nucleus supply process, were participants. This is critical if we are to actually achieve progress in saving what has been still an effective diplomatic mechanism over the last 30 years to prevent a complete breakout. We often fail to ask ourselves the question, what would happen, what would have happened in the last 30 years if there was no NPT? I think the consequences for the international order and Australia's security would have been grave indeed.
Just a final question. You could be Foreign Minister in just over a year. Of all the issues you've outlined tonight, what would be your priorities in the first couple of months?
Number one is getting China right, for the reasons I articulated before. Number two is because, not just because I've seen the Al Gore movie, but on the question of climate change, together with the Environment Minister, as it would then be, Anthony Albanese, to put right the wrong, which is our non-ratification of Kyoto. Number three, as I said before, if Doha and has still life in it, then to pull out all stops to resuscitate the round. But a personal project, and one of particular interest to me, is to rebuild an outfit and an organisation in the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs, which is once again proud of its ability to contribute to creative diplomatic solutions for a troubled world. I do not want to lead a department which is coward. I do not want to lead a department which sees that its responsibility is primarily to cover the ministers behind. I do not want to lead a department which spends tens of millions of dollars over time defending ministers from direct questions of ministerial accountability over weapon scandals and wheat scandals with Iraq. What I want is a department which is engaged with the big questions facing the region and the world, and at least a slice of them, four or five of them, of the type that I've listed here this evening, applying the best brains in the country in that agency to do what Australia does best, which is punch above our weight and deliver better security outcomes for the world and to play the role that Australia has played well in the past as a good international citizen.
We've had a great night, so I'll be very brief. An important speech with historical perspective, and Mr. Rudd showed a great grasp of issues in the lengthy discussion and detailed discussion and question period. So I think it's fair to say that Kevin Rudd's been a star performer for the Labor opposition over recent years, before and after the 2004 election. There's more to go in the next year, and no doubt he'll be back at the Institute again in the future. But for tonight, many thanks for a fine performance. Well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.